Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
more. Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. We're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and as always during the show we'll be joined by our former ITN journo turned pundit Derek Dyson. Former Matilda and now special comments expert with Ten and Optus, Amy Chapman will join us to discuss the disappointing result from the Matildas' friendly against the Republic of Ireland. Not quite the way Sam Kerr planned to spend her 100th cap with the national side. We'll talk more Socceroos and Matildas with Willem, of course, and a great story around our refereeing ranks in the Premier League. And then we'll pay our very own tribute to a titan of the game, Jimmy Greaves, who passed away earlier in the week with chief football writer with The Times, Henry Winter. And this is a man where the stats definitely don't say at all. He was England's fourth highest international goal scorer, Spurs' highest ever goal scorer as well, the highest goal scorer in the history of top flight football in England. But as Henry wrote this week so elegantly, he made a generation of football fans weep with joy over his elegant, nerveless finishing, and another generation cry with laughter as a wonderful television host, and all that after fighting with and winning his own personal demons. That will be a discussion to remember, and of course we will wrap it up with plenty of other stories in stoppage time. Now, Edge, you are on the road. You've escaped the Ring of Steel of Melbourne. Are you on a talent scouting mission in regional Victoria there?
Oh, I'm just doing a family favour to take someone home to some interview. So I did escape the Ring of Steel and have all the appropriate paperwork, Rob, but I've enjoyed a beautiful afternoon in regional Victoria, having a drive through some beautiful countryside. But let me just say, it's always a pleasure to be back with you on Box to Box. What a crazy week in Melbourne, eh? Daily protests and an earthquake. And did you know, Robert, Western United announced the earth is going to move for them as well. The building works will start on the 25th of October in their ambitious stadium project, and we do wish them very well. However, without any further delay, Willem's got plenty of news. Over to you, Willem van Denderen. Welcome back to Box to Box.
Thank you, Michael. One of the most insane weeks I can remember in old Melbourne town. But like everything else, Box to Box rolls on. Not great news for the Matildas. They've gone down 3-2 to Ireland in a midweek friendly. Tony Gustafsson labelled the effort not okay. Twice Ireland went ahead in the first half, but twice they were pegged back by Mary Fowler, who was clearly Australia's best on the night.
And the Aussies looking a little bit stretched early on here.
Still a chance for Australia to get level before the break. Here's Mary Fowler. Heavy deflection. It loops up and in. Fowler has a second, again a deflection. This game has been littered with them, and Mary Fowler has a brace against the country where her father was born, and Australia are level.
But the 33rd ranked Irish scored what would be the winner early in the second half. The match saw debuts for Charlotte Grant, Claire Wheeler and Angela Beard. We're going to be joined by former Matilda Amy Chapman shortly. But Michael, before we get there, I want to ask you, why have the Matildas been so poor in friendlies under Tony Gustafsson?
I think he's in an experimental phase, Willem. So he's trying new formations. He's giving players opportunities to have a look. So he's not playing the first 11 selection in those matches, and I think that's the short answer.
Football Australia is reportedly working with the federal government to assist arriving Afghan refugees to settle into local football clubs. The federal government earlier this month assisted members of the Afghan women's football side flee Afghanistan, and a further 3,000 refugees are on their way. The Sydney Morning Herald reported the team and thousands of others will have registration fees covered and arrangements made to integrate them into local clubs. And Dom Bossy had the yarn this week with a man named Hussein Ramazani, an Afghan refugee from a few years back who's been doing this sort of act out of the spotlight for many years. Rob, another fantastic example of what football can achieve as the world game.
Yeah, look, it is a great story, especially in light of the story around cricket and the fact that the test match against Afghanistan's been cancelled. Look, we're not a show about politics, but we know what's right and wrong in the world, and what is right is to help people who are going through the difficult times that the Afghanis are going through, and this country takes a lot of refugees from countries around the world. But the one way for sure to integrate people, whether they're migrants or refugees, into a new setting in a new country is to put them in an environment that they're comfortable in. So football is that perfect environment. So, yeah, that's just a great story, mate.
Legendary England and Tottenham striker turned much-loved pundit Jimmy Greaves this week passed away aged 81. Greaves scored 44 goals in 57 games for England and was part of their 1966 World Cup winning squad, and to this day remains Tottenham's leading scorer with 266 goals. Following his career that also took in time at Chelsea, AC Milan and West Ham, Greaves went on to co-host Saint and Greavesy in the late 80s and 90s alongside Ian St John. And Ian also sadly left us last year. Rob, I remember learning all about that show when we covered his passing. Now Jimmy's left us as well, and I know that you and Derek in particular are looking forward to our chat with Henry Winter a little bit later on.
Yeah, it'll be fantastic. I mean, look, I'm in my mid-50s now, and anyone who listens to this show know that my passion for football came from reading Roy of the Rovers. And I just have a recollection of the name Jimmy Greaves throughout the 70s as a young man reading stories of football. And I equated him in some sense to the great Australian sports people, you know, a Bradman of football, if you like. And, you know, the sad story of him being injured for that World Cup final, the loss of his 12-month-old, the battle that he had with alcohol. Just a legend of a man to have come through the worst of times and gotten through 80 years and dying at peace.
Over to Spain, tension at Barcelona has escalated this week with Ronald Koeman refusing to take questions from the press after their 1-1 draw with Granada. Barca have dropped points in two of their four opening La Liga matches and, as was well publicised, lost pretty poorly to Bayern Munich 3-0 in the Champions League. Club president Joan Laporte has made it clear he'd like to move Koeman on, but Spanish media outlet TV3 has reported Koeman would require a payout of €12 million. And Michael, as we know, that is money that they do not have at this point. So Koeman is going to stay and the pain is going to most likely continue.
Yeah, the pain will continue at Barca for some time, Willem. It's going to take some very crafty management to see this club through a very difficult time financially. They have no money. There's a salary cap put in by the new investors of the whole La Liga program. So this could be the end of one of the great clubs of European football.
And Rob, 5 or 6 years ago, we were sitting here going, when will Barcelona and Real Madrid ever not be contesting for the Champions League? But how the wheel turns, and it really is remarkable when you think back across the last 10 to 15 years of world football, how these two titans just continue to deepen in their malaise, particularly Barca.
Well, as I picked myself up off the floor after Edge declared the end of one of the great clubs of European football, as much as they're in a desperate straits, so I don't know that it's going to go that far. But one way or the other, the government or the La Liga will rescue them. They will come back. They might do a Rangers and have to drop out of the top flight. That's a possibility. Not out of the question for Juventus as well during the Calciopoli scandal for various reasons. Great clubs have dropped down. I mean, the pyramid of football does work that way in its own structure, let alone when crisis happens. This is the worst of times for Barcelona. They've let things get out of hand. They've signed ridiculous contracts with Koeman. They've had to let Messi go. This story is far from over yet. It'll be just train crash watching over the next 6 to 12 months to find out what happens from here.
A club that is in even more dire straits is Guangzhou FC of the Chinese Super League. They are well and truly on the verge of collapse and have transfer listed their entire squad in the hope of raising some cash to stay afloat. Guangzhou are owned by debt-ridden property development company China Evergrande Group. They've called on their local government to buy a stake in the club. Evergrande Group have reportedly bled between $150 and $300 million US annually on their football program over the past couple of years. And it's unfortunately, in Chinese football, Rob, not an issue that's been limited just to Evergrande. They're just one of many clubs who were sort of built financially on the property boom of sort of 10 to 15 years ago and are now struggling accordingly as the market does. There's sort of a widespread push to hopefully transfer some of the ownership into more stable institutions such as the government, the provincial governments of each club. But it's not hard to see how it's gotten to this. And in February, of course, another real titan of the Chinese Super League, Jiangsu, heavily tied in with the Jiangsu Retail Group, were dissolved. So not looking good at all for Guangzhou FC at the minute.
Yeah, these aren't good signs. And when you see high-rise buildings being blown up because they're not completed or for financial reasons can't be completed, it's the worst of times. I mean, Edge, you're more familiar than anyone that I know with Asian football. What sort of wake-up call is this for football in China?
it's a big wake-up call. There's been a litany of personality-type billionaire owners that have come in and out of the sport for reasons that are questionable, and this is just another continuing chapter in Chinese Super League history, which is, at the moment, really, really shaky.
And staying on a pretty similar topic, unfortunately, one of the clubs who have been covered most closely across the journey with Box to Box, of course, Derby County, very close to the heart of our great mate Dean Hennessy, have become the latest English club to enter administration and have been dealt the standard 12-point deduction, so that they are now on the bottom of the championship table. Mel Morris is the owner there. He's been so since 2015, but in that period, he has lost over £200 million, he estimates, with COVID-19 only contributing about a tenth of this. Morris has been actively looking to sell since 2019, and early signs are that there are a few potential buyers popping their heads up now that he said he really does need to sell. Michael, another real shame, and looking extremely tough for poor old Wayne Rooney, who's in charge there.
Well, it is said, Willem, if you're a billionaire and you want to become a millionaire, just buy a championship football club, because it is the quickest way to lose money. It is the most dangerous lottery ticket in the world. If you think you can buy a championship club and get him in the Premier League and make money, this is a good example. The £50 million they owe, £30 million of that is to the tax office. That is unavoidable. They are in more poo than a Werribee duck, Willem.
All right, Willem, well done. Edge, you take a little break. Willem and I are going to have a chat to Amy Chapman. We're going to talk about the, disappointing loss for the Matildas in their friendly against the Republic of Ireland. It was Sam Kerr's 100th match, and she copped a yellow card. But, the Tony Gustafsson era, sort of, it has a bit of a rollercoaster feel about it right now. We're going to talk to Amy about that next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, during the week, we'd hoped that the 100th cap for our national captain, Sam Kerr, with the Matildas, was going to be celebrated in fine style against the Republic of Ireland. Unfortunately, that was not to be. Former Matilda and our special comments expert with 10 and Optus, Amy Chapman, joins us. How are you, Amy?
Well, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
So you were sitting alongside Simon Hill and you saw every blow in that game. Coming off the back of what I think we, on reflection, should look at as a successful Olympic campaign, despite the fact that we missed out on a medal. There was a lot of expectation around Tony Gustafsson's side, despite the injuries, despite the retirements and some relative lack of youth, that against the 33rd ranks Republic of Ireland side, that we'd get the job done. But they just looked very rusty from the get-go, didn't they, the Matildas?
Yeah, they did. It's always a difficult game to call at 3, 4am in the morning with... The girls underperforming, if you could say that. But, yeah, I think there's since the Olympics and the performance that they've got, that's definitely the most successful tournament the Matildas have ever had, particularly at the Olympics. There's been a little bit of breathing space on Tony, and everyone was thinking, let's give him a free runway here and see what he can do. But certainly when you take out a few of those key players for the Matildas, that some big cracks start to open up, and I think that's exactly what we saw against Ireland.
Yeah, so there was injury, there were retirements, as I said, there were management of game time. 12 of the 24 players had less than 10 caps, and 6 were on debut. So I guess we couldn't expect too much, but even Tony himself said that the passing accuracy in the final third was down to 50%. So obviously indicates that we're giving every second ball away. The crossing accuracy down to 20%. These are just not the standards that we expect of a top 10 side in the world, are they?
No, and you would really expect the Matildas, regardless of whether that was what we would call a B team, missing, 4 or 5 key starters and key influences. Even still, that is not a good enough performance against Ireland. It was the first ever time we've played them, and having seen them play in the past, knowing those players week in, week out, a lot of them play in the WSL against these Matildas, we really should have dominated possession, dominated on the scoreboard, and at the very least gotten a result. So I think even a poor performance and got a result could have been something, but when you have not the result and poor performance, definitely defensively, the passing was well off. There was a couple of individual moments. Mary Fowler was a standout, and there certainly were moments, but geez, it was a pretty tough pill to swallow for the Matildas.
So, yeah, as you say, Amy, Mary Fowler, 18 years old, she was playing against the country of her father's birth. There was a real tug-of-war, as anyone watching the women's game would know, for Mary's allegiance. She declared for Australia, and allegiance was franked during the Olympics after quite a long stint in and around the camp. Insofar as Mary's concerned, probably the leading light of that match. Is this the player that we should be looking to for the foundation of the future as we build up towards the 2023 World Cup?
I think so. She's shown on many different stages what she's capable of. She's playing in one of the best leagues in the world over in France, and she's every time she's been asked to do something and come up with something, she has. Yeah, probably a little bit lucky on those deflections, but she was creating moments in those games that nobody else was. So she's certainly a shining light. And, you know, to Tony's credit, he is trying to find these replacement players, and there's a lot of question marks over the defence of the Matildas. Have conceded an unbelievable amount of goals in their last 14 games. So certainly there's some pieces of the puzzle that we need to work on, and he did not find it against Ireland.
Yeah, definitely right. The seventh game out of the last 12, we've conceded three or more. This is Box to Box. We are talking to Amy Chapman, former Matilda, now special comments expert with Ten and Optus.
Amy, during Tony Gustafsson's tenure, the Matildas have fired up when it mattered, and that was, of course, the Olympics. But other than that, the friendly losses have started to mount up. Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, Japan, and now Ireland. He has handed 10 debuts out to players during this period. So, of course, there's an element of experimentation whenever a new manager comes in. But do you think maybe consistent motivation, finding a way to motivate them consistently, is starting to become a bit of a pattern with this side, or nothing to worry about as he continues to sort of turn the list over a little bit?
No, I think there are some concerns, definitely. I think having lost so many matches, it's not normal for the Matildas, who were at one point fifth in the world, and now have dropped out of the top 10. So that's certainly concerning. I think it's not the motivation piece. You've seen when they need to, they can turn on performance mode. You can see when they drop off in a friendly, the floodgates seem to open. It does fall apart a little bit there. And I think it's been known for a long time, pre-Tony, that the depth in the Matildas squad is not there. And we do have a lot of attacking talent, but within that midfield, you lose the likes of Ivy Lewick, who actually was fantastic in the Olympics, 35, 36 years of age now. And we don't have a true number six coming through that is ready to play at international level. So I think that's where the concerns come together. And I think the losses against Germany and those kind of things, you can talk your way out of. A loss to Ireland at any stage, I don't think you can talk your way out of that one.
And I just want to go back to the discussion around how young this Matildas side was. And that is fair enough when you consider that, as mentioned, eight of the Olympic squad were absent. But if you look at the starting 11 on paper for this clash, Kennedy, Polkinghorn, Yallop, Legazzo, Catley, Gielnick and Kerr. That to me doesn't look particularly sort of inexperienced or young. So with that in mind, do you think it is that lack of depth that then is the deeper issue rather than just experience?
Yeah, probably a combination of both. And there was certainly enough experience and enough balance out there to perform and win that game. But I think when you're playing with a back three, if you start to look shaky and the shape is not right, it's a real personnel thing. And without Ellie Carpenter, I don't think the Matildas can successfully play in a back three. So I think they looked exposed, and then that changed the whole tempo of the game. And the other really crucial position where we did have those young faces, like Kara Cooney-Cross, in the midfield, is that's where you want your experience. Someone who can get on the ball, control the tempo, a bit of composure. And I think that's really what was missing against Ireland, who I will give credit to, were very aggressive and probably played one of the best games they've played in a long time.
And on to the future, another three debutants handed caps, and they all saw good game time, at least 20 minutes for all three of Claire Wheeler, Charlotte Grant and Angela Beard. Just your comments on the debuts of those three.
Yeah, I think that's an exciting time for those girls. A tough match to come on, but certainly, I thought Angie Beard did really well. I couldn't fault her performance when she came on. She tried to lift the tempo. Her passing was a lot better than some of those already on the field. So I think she did really well. Everyone's excited and talking about Claire Wheeler as well. She's been exceptional in the W League. And I think she plays at the right tempo to really take it to that next level. But early days for those young girls. But, you know, it's great that you can have some fresh blood coming on.
And Amy, Tony Gustafsson, we saw the wobbly start to his era in the friendlies before the Olympics. We saw the team and Tony, his passion on the sideline and his tactical nous really pulled that squad together to get so close to a medal, get some amazing results during that tournament. He does look to be the kind of manager that can pull this side together as we transition from retirements, getting the best out of our superstars and bringing some of the young talent through.
Yeah, and I think it's I've had a couple of conversations with Tony, and he's very charismatic. He's very liked by the girls, and the culture he's creating in those camps is all positive. Everybody seems to be enjoying playing under him and learning his philosophy. I think, again, it has been a really difficult time for someone to take over a team. For the first 12 months, he had barely met any of the players, so it's very difficult to teach players the way you want to play. And a lot of these girls have had to travel a really long way over to Europe. Some of them not sure how they're going to get home. So there's a lot of different factors, and we're not making excuses, but I think he's done a pretty good job in terms of the culture, given the circumstances that he's been dealt.
And Amy, speaking of culture, I know this is a tough question. It's not a popular question in some circles, but there are some who are questioning the temperament of the number one superstar in the squad and her capacity to be the captain of this team long term. Sam Kerr was yellow carded again in this match as her frustrations at the result were clear. Is it time that that we recognise that as brilliant a player and greater a legend that she may well be in the history of not only women's football but football and sport in general in this country, that captaincy might just not be for Sam Kerr?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's not a traditional role for the number nine. Usually they're quite focused on their individual performance and scoring goals. But off the field, she actually does have a really nice aura about her, and she does lead whether she wants to or not. She does have that role on and off the field, and people do look to her, for her to step up and change games, which is what she does. And for me, I'd like to have a mixture of both Sam and somebody else holding that responsibility for her as well, because you do want her to just be her charismatic self, score goals, be a bit feisty if she needs to. Certainly could see the frustration coming out in that game, and rightly so. She was getting some awful delivery from very, very deep in her half, and she's a goal scorer. That's what she wants to do, so she needs to have better service than she had.
And Amy, just on to you personally to close. Your first match on the call with Channel 10. Congratulations on being part of the new era from the get-go. You mentioned the early wake-up was tough, but other than that, how did you find the experience with the new broadcasters?
Oh, it's exciting. It's a new era for football in Australia, from everything the W League, A League and the national team. So I think it's exciting, and you can see that Channel 10 really want to make something of this. They want to build their own brand with this, and the birth of the APL has also been excellent. We've seen Wellington Phoenix come into the W League. So there's a lot of really good positive things coming out. And, I'm really looking forward to being involved in a lot more of the commentary, hopefully doing a lot of commentary with the A League so we get more female voices and it just becomes the norm, which is great.
Yeah, that's exactly what we need, Amy. And look, we've been big supporters of the women's game since we started this podcast back in 2015, and we'll continue to be, and enjoy the W League every bit as much as the A League and the Matildas as much as the Socceroos as time goes by. Thanks so much for your time, Amy. Good luck with your work with the television coverage in the future. We'll sit back and enjoy with interest and look forward to chatting to you again real soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Amy Chapman. Now, stick around. After the break, we're going to talk more Matildas. We're going to talk more Socceroos. There's plenty going on, including a great story about one of our referees about to make his Premier League debut this weekend on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial
goal. This is Box to Box. Great chat with Amy Chapman about the Matildas. We're going to talk more Matildas in a moment, more Socceroos in a moment. Edge is back on the line. But before we do, if you are running low on your everyday vitamins or cosmetics but can't get to the shops, Chemist Warehouse has the solution. You can stock up on everything you need by simply shopping online at chemistwarehouse.com.au. Just spend $30 or more and Chemist Warehouse will deliver your order within 3 hours for free. That's right, just $30 or more at Chemist Warehouse and they'll deliver your order within 3 hours for free. Everyone needs to spend $30 at Chemist Warehouse. It's easy to get free delivery. So go on, spoil yourself with your essential health and wellness needs with free delivery within 3 hours from Chemist Warehouse to your house. But you better hurry. This offer ends, thank you, Willem, on October the 31st and excludes prescriptions and pharmacist-only medication. Selected stores only. Chemist Warehouse. Oh, Michael on the line from regional Victoria. Fast delivery powered by DoorDash. That is our friends at Chemist Warehouse. Okay, well, and we've already talked Matildas. Bad loss. We haven't had Edge's feel on this one, apart from his opening remarks when we kicked the show off. But where are you going to take us from here?
Well, with the Matildas in national camp, I'm going to take us straight to Socceroos Central this week, Rob. And it is, of course, for the Green and Gold Army, the team behind the scenes at Green and Gold Army. Geez, they work hard, and they're putting the final touches on their Qatar World Cup 2022 packages. So what better time to jump on board? It couldn't be easier. Just sign up to the mailing list at ggatravel.com.au and be amongst the first to know when information on that tour and plenty of others drops. And guys, the box-to-box magic wore off beautifully for Jackson Irvine just 2 days after chatting to us. Made his starting debut with St. Pauli. And what a day it was as they put four past Ingolstadt to climb to third in the Bundesliga 2. Rob, how early is too early to dream about Jackson playing in the German top flight?
Well, it didn't wear off. It worked beautifully. I think they might have been the words you were looking for.
Yes, it rubbed off.
Yeah, that's better. Like a genie in its lamp. No, it's fantastic. Well, I mean, St. Pauli have a wonderful history in the top flight, but they are a bit of a yo-yo club, aren't they? It would be wonderful to see Jackson's career be part of a promotion charge for a club like that. And, you know, you could just imagine with crowds back in the stadiums, the atmosphere that's built up there, a great culture in the club. We'll be watching his journey very, very closely. And as you say, mate, if we can get him into the top flight, that would be incredible.
Willem, do you like the chocolate brown strip of St. Pauli?
I do indeed. Absolutely. Very dapper, very classy. And you'd expect nothing less from such a stylish town.
Correct. I like it too.
Denny Jeanreau at Toulouse, he's also wearing a beautiful strip, a sort of a purpley mauve blue sort of colour, and he played 90 minutes in a 4-1 win over Grenoble, where Alex Gersbach was on the pine. Up in Scotland, Martin Boyle scored his 8th of the campaign for Hibs, while in the Ross County Hearts clash, three Aussies were making their debuts: Cam Devlin, Alexander Robertson and Ashley Maynard Brewer. So well done to all the young lads there. To Japan, old Melbourne Victory teammates Mitch Langerak and Kevin Muscat squared off, and it was Langerak who took the chocolates, Nagoya winning 2-1 over Yokohama. But Michael, what was Muskie doing? His side are now 7 points off top, and he was booked for allegedly whistling at a couple of the Nagoya players while they were on the attack. He's denied it was him, but J-League fans have very quickly dredged up an old article about him receiving a yellow card for similar actions during a victory match in 2019.
Yeah, the old Kevin Muscat, we know that from time to time a bit of scorpion comes out. It definitely, he used to get white line fever as a player, and we do know that he can get grumpy on the sideline. And even though Kevin didn't do it, he probably did, didn't he, Willem?
They are your words. And Rob, what's going on with Harry Kewell? You think he's going to be the Socceroos manager, but he can't cut it in Div 5. He's been sacked by Barnett after just 7 games.
Yeah, the second time he's been sacked in 6 months, old H. It's not the sort of career trajectory that you'd like. But I did give him a long, long time. I think I'd given him somewhere till around his mid-60s to take over the role from Ange Postecoglou and then Graham Arnold and whoever happens to fill the role after that. But yeah, look, I do feel...
modern medicine to hold out that long role, I think.
Yeah, look, I'd feel for Harry. I mean,
come on, Rob, what's his next gig? He's been going through the leagues in the English football pyramid. He's ended up in the National League. My God, what's next?
Well, look, it's just part of the role. I mean, as we all know, there are two types of football managers, ones who are going to be sacked and ones who are sacked.
You'd have to say stocks are on the slide, wouldn't you, Rob? Well, I mean, you've talked him up as a future Socceroos coach. I mean, this is really your forum to explain yourself.
No, I'm comfortable with the fact that a coach gets sacked regularly. I mean, many, many coaches have been sacked over the journey. So, you know, it's not like he's in an exclusive club here. But, you know, he's learning from the journey. And I still back in Harry. I think, you know, there were times during his career, we all remember, where, you know, we criticised him for not playing for the national side. He seemed to be a selfish player, but then he turned it all around and became one of the heroes of 2005 against Uruguay. He was one of the great players in Germany 2006. So, you know, Harry has got the capacity to turn around, and I'm backing him to do it.
Jared Gillett will become the first overseas ref to take charge of a Premier League match this weekend when Watford host Newcastle. Gillett arrived in the UK 2 years ago, and while completing postdoctorate studies in Liverpool, he's climbed the football pyramid as a ref. After starting in League Two, he's refereed over 50 championship fixtures, including a playoff semi-final, the FA Cup, and now, Rob, the Premier League. He is clearly a very high achiever, but extremely understated and humble in all of the comments he makes in the press, and there were quite a lot of people who criticised him and the standard of A-League refereeing when he was here. So hopefully this has put that into a bit of perspective for those people.
Yeah, look, I think it has. A career trajectory for him has been only on the up, as opposed to our old mate Harry here. And not only from the point of view of his on the field performances, but the very fact that, as anyone who's followed his career knows, that he did leave the country to do his postdoctorate studies into cerebral palsy, which obviously, you know, I have a personal interest in with my little Alexander, 16 years old now. Ambassador for Storage King's fundraising for September, by the way, if you don't mind. But yeah, look, it's just wonderful news for a guy who deserves it. I think he went over there for the right reasons, but he's managed to juggle two careers at the same time. So it's not very often we give a huge rap to an official, but he's one well-deserved.
Western Melbourne Group have announced works on Western United Stadium in Tarneit will commence in the final week of October. The concept master plan of the stadium has been before the state government since July, but hasn't been ticked off, but preliminary works can proceed. That will be almost 3 years, Michael, since they were granted their A-League licence on the provision that they'd build a stadium shortly. That's great news for Western United, but as the weeks worn on, it's gotten a little bit messy because they also announced in the interim they'll host 7 matches at Lakeside Stadium, and that is, of course, the home of South Melbourne. South Melbourne, 4 hours after that announcement, pushed back, and I paraphrase here, executives at Lakeside Stadium have advised South Melbourne, contrary to the announcement made by Western United, there is no written or signed agreement in place with United or the APL to allow access to Lakeside for the upcoming A-League season. Now this, Michael, is about as tasty as it gets. It is old soccer against new football. South Melbourne, as far as I can tell, are not the owners, they are the tenants. So do they really have much power in this situation?
Time is going to tell, because South Melbourne will say they do, but it sounds like Western Melbourne Group have done a deal with the people that are, you know, Parks Victoria, that are sort of managing the precincts. So we will see what transpires out of that one. But nothing like when South Melbourne get their nose out of joint. It's always tasty and entertaining rhetoric coming out of Lakeside. They love a drum to beat.
They most certainly do. Quick FFA Cup wrap. Just the one match was played within the past week. Lions FC have become the third Queensland side to reach the final 16. That's the third time in their history that they've done it. They took care of Darwin-based side Casual Arena 6-0 pretty comfortably. Jordan Farina, who's the son of Frank, and I hope Jordan doesn't mind me calling him that because I know lots of sons and daughters as time goes on want to step out of the shadows. So he's done so here. He scored a brace. Also in the score sheet was former A-League cult hero Jean-Carlos Solorzano. The competition is now headed west for two matches across the next week. On Sunday afternoon, Floreat Athena host Adelaide United. Then on Wednesday, ECU Joondalup host Adelaide Olympic. And guys, a quick update on Joondalup striker Danny Hodgson. He is still in intensive care in a coma, and his parents are in hotel quarantine and will hopefully see him in the coming days. But he has opened his eyes, so there are some encouraging signs there. This week, a charity match was played between Joondalup and Perth Glory, and $10,000 was raised, Rob.
Yeah, that's a wonderful story. And so relieving, if that's a word, for his parents and all of his family and loved ones that he's starting to open his eyes and the prospects are starting to look just a little bit better. So, hopefully the start of a good news story to end just there. All right, Willem, well done. We are now going to have a chat to Henry Winter after the break about Jimmy Greaves. What a wonderful career he had as a footballer and then off the pitch. Just a wonderful life, and Henry wrote a great article. So, Edge, you enjoy the rest of your time in regional Victoria, and we'll catch up with you next week, mate, and we'll have a chat to Henry in between.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you next week, Rob. Have a great week and enjoy the rest of the show.
Good on you, mate. Stick around. Henry Winter after the break on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box, and in this past week we lost another legend of football. His Obits were written and written beautifully in England, his home, where he was top scorer for Tottenham Hotspur, where he was a star in his own right at Chelsea before going to Italy. The tragedy of missing the 1966 World Cup final, but he is a player that made his name as much off the park in his post career as well, and he's a name that's very well known to all Australian sports fans. And to eulogise and remember the great Jimmy Greaves, we welcome back to Box, the chief football writer of the Times, Henry Winter. How are you, Henry?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
No, not at all, Henry. And Henry, Jimmy Greaves was a man of so many different colours, wasn't he? He was a working class player. He debuted with Chelsea, and obviously was one of the early players to play on the continent. He is forever synonymous with the injury that he had in the group stages of the 1966 World Cup campaign, missing out in Alf Ramsey's final side. So where do you start with a man like Jimmy Greaves?
Well, I would start at half time of Spurs game at the weekend against Chelsea, where the club put together a very moving montage on the big screens. And obviously a few of the fans had sort of gone inside to get their pies and the pints and whatever. It's probably salad nowadays. But the majority of them actually sort of just stood and just admired Greaves. It obviously graced both clubs. I mean, you know, one of those nice moments of sporting symmetry that the fixture list had actually put up his two, you know, the two club, the one club, Chelsea, where he made his name, and then Tottenham Hotspur, where he had such a fantastic decade and broke so many records. And just, it was just great for sort of people to see the range of his goals, and for me to see the range of his goals too. And, you know, everyone thinks of him as a sort of, because of the number of goals that he scored, people sort of say, well, he's almost like a sort of Gerd Müller type. He was just in the 6-yard box finishing. But it was just the range of his goals, you know, sort of dribbling from the centre circle, that amazing balance, two-footed, could go either way, leaving defenders sort of going one way, but he would go the other. He could score with near-post headers. You know, he could, either foot. It was just the sort of range of the goals that was really appreciated. And I think, as you mentioned, the fact that he then went into television, and he was actually a revolutionary in television. A lot of the programs we have in the UK are influenced, whatever it is, so 20, 30 years on, by what Saint and Greavesy, Ian St John, Liverpool legend, and Jimmy Greaves, Spurs in England legend, did. And it was just the sort of the humour, two ex-pros looking like they'd just sort of stepped from the dressing room, just sort of chatting, making a few jokes about the game, taking the mickey out of one or two of the players, modern fads and all that. And it was, I mean, I was at university in Scotland at the time, and I would watch it with about sort of 70 mad Scots, and they absolutely, before we played, and they would absolutely love Jimmy Greaves, even though he was English. And it was just one of those unmissable events. And it was, I think, ran for about 6 or 7 years, St. Greavesy. And it changed the face, certainly in the UK, of how football was presented on television.
And of course, Henry, we've mentioned he started his career with Chelsea and joined Milan. But that iconic part of his life and his career where he was injured in the group stages, had 5 stitches in a gash in his shin. But so humble in acknowledging that that Sir Alf Ramsey did make the right decision ultimately in picking a man who went on to score a hat-trick in that final, become a knight, and Jimmy Greaves had to sit in the grandstand as a player injured who would have been a first picked player under most circumstances.
Well, it was extraordinary. I mean, you can just imagine now in the age of social media what the reaction would have been. I mean, he got his fitness back, but the fact that Jeff Hurst had sort of come in and settled and was scoring and was doing well. You know, Alf Ramsey, ultimately his decision to, you know, was vindicated to leave Jimmy Greaves out of the final. I mean, it was interesting talking to some of the former England players who played in 66 down the years. They still said that they were shocked when Alf Ramsey read the team out that morning of the final and Jimmy Greaves wasn't starting. You know, it was a huge call as ever during that golden tournament. Ramsey got most of his calls right. But as you alluded to, that the fact that Jimmy, how bitter he was deep down, I don't think he was a naturally bitter person. I think he's, you know, he kind of got on with life, but there must have been a huge frustration, particularly as the years went on and that 66 team became even more lauded as you know, the years of hurt, as we call them. So, no, it was a huge thing. I mean, you know, he admitted to disappointment and hurt, but it wasn't, I don't think it completely changed his life. I think there were other issues in his life. Obviously, the alcoholism that he had in the 70s was far bigger. I mean, a remarkable man and a huge family man. It's just a great. And what's been lovely is just other clubs with no association with Jimmy Greaves would put his picture on the front cover. I mean, I was at, I can't remember what it was, Manchester City. I was there two nights ago, and the applause for him before the kickoff. You know how they do these things. You know, they say that they read the tribute and then they say, and now we'll have a minute's applause. The minute's applause started, you know, about 30 seconds before, and it was very moving because he was so loved in this country. Plus, also one final thing you have to say is that he wasn't probably appreciated by the establishment. It took him only until 2 years ago for him to get an MBE for what he'd done for the game, for communities, for charities, and also for television.
Henry, obviously Spurs have their own very talented England forward in Harry Kane. Can you draw comparisons between the two of them as strikers based on what you saw of Jimmy and what we see from Harry now? Or has Harry still got a long way to go in terms of setting those standards?
Harry Kane's still got a long way to go, but you can see him, particularly now we know he's staying at Tottenham Hotspur, you know, you can see him threatening Greaves' Spurs goal-scoring record. I think those who saw Jimmy Greaves in his pomp, I mean, Spurs fans still, you know, sort of reminisce about the excitement of walking up to White Hart Lane when Jimmy Greaves was playing, almost with an expectation that he would score, and also an understanding and appreciation and delight that he would do it in style. I mean, he was such a sort of, obviously these skills are honed in the playground and on the streets, particularly for Greaves' generation, but he was such a natural finisher. I think if you look at Harry Kane, he's really a product, obviously, of certain gifts, but also he really worked on his finishing. Such a hard trainer, you know. Even Jimmy Greaves' former teammates, who loved him dearly, said that Jimmy wasn't, you know, the most natural of trainers. He came alive when the ball came out and the referee blew the first whistle on match day. So slightly different players in terms of their approach to the game. And Jimmy Greaves was a child marvel. I mean, one of his first training sessions at Chelsea, he was sort of brought over from the youth team as a sort of callow 15, 16-year-old. And he got the ball quite deep and he started running, and the coaches on the sideline were saying, lay it off, what are you doing? And then he sort of, you know, left three people on their backside and first teams on their backside and put the ball past the goalkeeper. And then he ran back to the halfway line and said, I don't have anyone to pass to. I thought I'd just pass it into the net. You know, so he was very precocious, prodigious from a young age, whereas Harry Kane was obviously very admired. He had to go off on loan and sort of develop his skills. So, you know, slightly different. I mean, I'm sure Harry Kane would rather be playing through the middle rather than on the left wing, as Nuno played him the other day against Chelsea, which didn't really work. But in terms of the affection that the nation, you know, has for them, I mean, absolutely huge. But Jimmy Greaves was really in everyone's heart, partly because of the, you know, the alcoholism that he fought and he talked about so honestly. You know, I mean, his 1979 autobiography had the word alcoholic, you know, in huge letters on the front page. You know, he didn't hide from it. And he said if one person bought that book and it, you know, it saved them from drink, then the whole exercise of writing the book was worthwhile, and people really admired him for that, as well as the television. Harry Kane is, you know, he's a magnificent sportsman and a good role model, but he's a slightly more one-dimensional character.
We are obviously, just by the passing of time, Henry, losing more and more of those of those characters in and around the 1966 team. We mentioned the story a little earlier, and Greaves is just the latest to go. I mean, do you think, I suppose, the current and modern generation of footballer really really understands just how important that group of players actually was? And what would you say to people who had maybe never heard of Jimmy Greaves before the news of his death about him, and encourage them to find out more?
Well, you're very fortunate because you live in a country where you've had many great sporting moments and achievements. Whereas I think in England, we are still, I mean, I was three at the time, but we're utterly obsessed with 1966. It's the greatest sporting moment. That generation are absolutely revered. And as you say, tragically, as they do, one or two of them have passed, or I think six or seven now, you know, and there's and the dementia that's affected some of them. I mean, it's heartbreaking for the nation. So in terms of Greaves's legacy, I mean, the good thing now is that kids will go on YouTube. Kids will look at what he did, particularly if it's sort of packaged in sort of 2-3 minutes of bite-sized bursts. And kids are talking about Jimmy Greaves, and they are comparing, saying, "Oh, well, some of the stuff he did, particularly with his left foot, you know, is reminiscent of Lionel Messi," which is a great compliment in itself. And particularly, I think, as you know, younger generations are particularly statistically obsessed. You've only got to look at Jimmy Greaves' numbers. I mean, six times, you know, the first division, the elite division's leading goal scorer. I mean, his numbers were phenomenal. Ratio-wise, he's comfortably England's greatest ever striker. So there's a huge appreciation for him, looking at him statistically, but looking at just the beauty of the goals that he scored. And it's quite interesting talking to sort of like my kids' generation. They're okay, just look at those pitches. You know, are you sure he wasn't playing in a farm? You know, it was like a ploughed field that he was floating across. And then you also had to look, if you look at the slightly sort of longer sort of YouTube footage, you look at some of the tackles that were going in on players like Jimmy Greaves, and he was just rising above it. You know, he had a sort of moral courage, a physical courage, and he could actually play through the raised studs. So, yeah, absolutely. I think the whole country has united in its grief, and also it's for Jimmy Greaves, and sympathy and condolences to the family, but also an appreciation of what an absolutely magnificent footballer he was in his prime.
Oh, exactly. And I guess the humanity of the man. You talked about his troubles with his alcoholism. We haven't even mentioned the fact that that he and his wife Irene lost their first son at just 12 months old. And I think the thing is here that most people can relate to a person like that. We all have our highs and lows in life, our challenges that we've got to get through. But when you see somebody who scaled the highest of heights and plummeted to the lowest of lows to be able to drag themselves out and not only just reclaim his own life, but as you said, Henry, to help so many others who suffered from the scourge of alcoholism, as Jimmy did, and he made it part of his life's mission to help others, I suspect one of the reasons why people just loved him so much.
Yeah, there was a great love story in there as well with Irene, who he married young. I mean, you know, he talks about it in very openly in the book, that they were very close to getting divorced, you know, in the darkest days of his drinking. And then, you know, that I think eventually they renewed their marriage vows and, you know, love conquered all. And it was just, and it was interesting talking to some of my colleagues in the press box who ghosted his columns down the years. And they would talk about just such a lovely, warm character. He would invite them over to his place in Spain, and they would, you know, and this is a sign of a strong man, that Jimmy Greaves, he was an alcoholic, he was fighting it, but he was strong enough to allow a bottle of wine in his fridge, so when guests came and, you know, journalists like a drink, and if they sort of, you know, travelled over, he would make sure they had that, and he was strong enough to be able to have a bottle of wine in the fridge close at hand, and knowing that he could resist it, and what a message that is. So, yeah, remarkable man on and off the pitch.
Yeah, and his final season in the first division took his goal-scoring tally to 357 goals in the first division. And along with the 9 goals at AC Milan, he scored 366 goals in the top 5 European leagues, a record that lasted until 2017 when it was passed by one Cristiano Ronaldo, which we know you obviously know, Henry, but for anyone who was in any doubt as to the greatness of the man, then that statistic should underscore the whole thing. And we haven't even talked about his motor racing and all sorts of things. I just loved, you mentioned earlier, the YouTube clips. One of my favourite clips was from Saint and Greavesy, where, look, I'm not even going to try and to tell the gag, but I just encourage anyone to just type in Saint and Greavesy and look at for the Cambridge versus Oxford rowing joke, and part of the chemistry was just so wonderful that Saint just thought that everything that Jimmy said was just so funny, and you could just tell. And the funny thing about it was, it just was funny.
Yeah, they were great double acts. You know, I mean, it was, you know, the great strikers often work with another striker, and they bring the best out of each other, a foil, and that also worked for in the television studio with Jimmy as well. I mean, he was just, honestly, those programs were just, you know, I mean, I used to sort of play to a non-league level after that, and I was still laughing for the first 5 minutes of games because people, and then I realized the tackles coming in.
It's so funny. But look, and that's what it is, isn't it? Football, it's sport, it's a joy, and that's what we should never forget, that it's a pastime still, before it's a business, and all the money that confuses people as to what its very existence is all about. Henry, we love having a yarn to you. We read your copy all the time in the Times, and anyone who doesn't, well, you better do yourself a favour and subscribe, because Henry Winter is one of the great sports writers there is. Henry, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on. And I just hope that the Ashes go ahead, because that is a sporting highlight I never want to miss.
Oh, exactly. And when you do come down here again, mate, we've got a seat in the members at the MCG or the SCG or anywhere else for you, mate, just waiting. So you know, once all this COVID stuff is over, it's something we'll really look forward to, mate, when you get the chance to visit yourself.
Definitely. We'll meet again, as the song goes.
We will, Henry. Henry Winter from The Times. Okay, stick around. There's more football to talk on Box to Box in stoppage time.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
Yes, this is Box to Box. We're going to bring it home with all the big stories we've missed in stoppage time. The fourth official has given us, let's say, plenty of time to discuss that. Derek and Willem are on the line. But before we do, we just want to have a bit of a chat to you about our great mates at Storage King. You're moving house, you're decluttering, or you just simply need more space, then you know where to go. You go to Storage King. They are Canstar Blues 2021 Most Satisfied Customer Award winner. How about that? Rated 5 stars for value for money, safety and security, quality of storage and convenience. All the things you want to know when you're going to store your stuff, your valuable stuff. With contactless moving, Storage King will keep you as safe as the things you store. So visit storageking.com.au and let Storage King give you back some space. Now, Derek, plenty more to talk about. What are you going to start us off with, mate?
Good evening, gents. I want to start with the sort of ever-rumbling row, let's say, between Pep Guardiola and Manchester City supporters. Pep took the unusual step after their Champions League game last week to really kind of backhanded criticise the fans for not turning up for those key midweek games. They had 38,000 in their 55,000 capacity stadium for their 6-3 romp over the German side Leipzig, and he suggested that more fans should attend. The wags out there have called the Etihad Stadium the Empty Had, in a little bit of punning wizardry there. And of course, at the weekend, they drew 0-0 with Southampton and didn't look at the races at all. So my question simply to both of you, but maybe starting with you, Rob, is does Pep have a point, or do you think he probably went one step too far there?
No, I don't think he went one step too far, because I obviously have a bias with Liverpool and the memorable midweek European nights. So, look, you can't have your cake and eat it too. And we all know the fractious relationship that Manchester City fans have with UEFA and the Champions League and all of that. But the reality here is, if you want to be one of the mega clubs around the world, then you've got to turn up. And you look at Manchester United. They had a midweek clash against West Ham and had 70,000 at Old Trafford. Trafford for a League Cup match. So, I think Guardiola's got a point, and I just sense that it's a little bit of sensitivity around the fan base. They've got, if not the greatest manager, then one of the greatest managers in the world. And if he can't speak his mind, then what's the point of having him?
Derek, do you think this is maybe just an ongoing symptom of a club that sort of outgrew itself so quickly financially? And, people often do say that they are, in reality, in terms of, they're as old as anyone, so it's not fair to say in terms of history, but in terms of sort of achievement beyond or past the modern era and in terms of fan base, they're certainly not one of the bigger clubs. Now they've got a stadium and a bank balance and a growing trophy cabinet that says that they should be one of the biggest clubs. So do you think that it's maybe just an imbalance in the history of the club rather than fickle modern-day supporters?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I've got to be careful what I say here because, first and foremost, prior to the Qatari takeover, Manchester City, extremely well-liked and supported club, a very loyal fan base that actually went through quite a lot with multiple relegations and it didn't look great for City, say, 20 years ago. Yes, when they look over at their neighbours next door, and when they look up at Liverpool, up the world, and even look at, let's face it, lowly Arsenal at the moment, their ability to market themselves around the world is limited. Are people flying in from all over to watch City? Probably not. Are they in the shadow of a much more illustrious rival? Yeah, absolutely. I think there's probably a few other factors at play too, to be honest. The City fans, there is no love lost with them with the Champions League. It seems to be that the fans definitely tend to prioritise the domestic stuff, and particularly the Premier League. You've also got to ask yourself about whether there's too much football, and particularly these Wednesday nights, they're not easy for people to get to, particularly families, people with families. Maybe I know that Liverpool, generally fill up their stadium for any kind of match day, particularly Europe. Arsenal, I can tell you, when we were in the Champions League, when I was there eight years ago, we really struggled to fill the Emirates Stadium on a cold winter night with, Ludogorets in town. Didn't inspire, even for season ticket holders that, had that match in our, as part of our package. I went to them, but there were plenty of fans around me who were season ticket holders who didn't go. And just as a final point, I wonder if there's a purity issue maybe going on here. I wonder if all Manchester City fans, particularly the dyed-in-the-wool ones, are bought into this project, in the way, that maybe the people from Abu Dhabi, people from Abu Dhabi would like. There's a galaxy of talent. There's no doubt that, if this team suddenly came to Melbourne, I think we'd all be season ticket holders and we'd want to watch De Bruyne and the rest of them playing. But it's a strange one, and I think Pep's got to be careful. English football fans are extremely passionate, they're extremely loyal. Pep's a genius and Pep's a well-regarded manager, but I'm not entirely sure it is his place to tell fans when and when they shouldn't be attending matches. One club with him that, just as a side note, doesn't generally have problems with attendances is Celtic, and I believe you've got a line or two on how they're going.
Yeah, well, the heat's come on Ange Postecoglou for the first time this week, Derek. So I've been watching the majority of the games, and the main sort of bane of contention was a really disappointing 1-0 loss away to Livingston. Now, by all reports, that is certainly not a team that they should be losing to in the league. But in terms of Ange, he commented that the team, since he's gotten there, has really been in a constant state of flux, and that's true. I mean, every match I watch, there's injuries, there's new guys in the lineup, and he just hasn't been able to settle on a dependable 11. Kyogo Furuhashi, the guy he brought across from Japan, who was the star of the J-League with Kobe Vissel alongside Andreas Iniesta, he had a brilliant start, but he went down with an injury in during international duty with Japan, so that hasn't been working for them. Callum McGregor is clearly the star of the side. He's the captain and he's integral to Scotland as well. He scored at the Euros. He's really been missed in the past couple of matches in the Europa League, and then against Livingston as well. There's also, Derek, been a bit of a furor around a man I'm sure you would have seen a bit of, and that is James McCarthy, of course, formerly of of Crystal Palace and an honest stayer at Premier League level. It's been sort of reported that Ange Ange and his coaches didn't have much of a say in his recruitment. It was more of a board decision, and he was really sort of lackluster and probably doesn't have the feet or the legs to play Ange's up-tempo sort of style. So some concern there around James McCarthy. Another couple of signings, Gio Kamakis, a Greek striker. He was the top scorer in the Eredivisie last season. He hasn't been able to hit the park either. So there's plenty of mitigating factors, and I think genuine excuses for Ange Postecoglou at the minute. But as we know, Derek and Rob, we'll go to you, Rob. European football isn't particularly interested in excuses as losses to teams such as Livingston start to mount up.
No, not at all. It seemed to us that the welcome, we spoke to Jordan Campbell from The Athletic early doors in Ange's tenure, had been quite welcoming. They didn't know who he was, but obviously the press explained his history well to them, and they understood that he was a man with a pedigree and he could actually do something. You know, some good results early, but there's only one measure of success, and if he doesn't start to turn this around soon and things start to career out of control, there'll be a phone call to Sam Allardyce and Ange will be looking for a new job.
And Derek, it seems just sort of following Celtic and a couple of the journos, the Celtic-specific journos on Twitter, there really is a divide between the fan bases. There are those sort of, there's the realists and then there's the sort of rabbits, if that makes sense. And they're the fans who have already started to sort of kick up a fuss, whereas the more sort of considered voices seem to be sort of more aligning with he's had a few issues and to give him a little bit of time. It's sort of a difficult question, but at what point do you think the wheel might turn? I guess what I'm trying to say is, it's borrowed time already, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is. I my read is that there is sympathy for Ange Postecoglou. I feel like, he has been given a handball in terms of some of the things that he's had to deal with, and most of the ire has been with the top brass. That being said, the top brass have still got expectations over the performance of the club. Losing to Rangers in the Old Firm is painful, but also Rangers are a decent side and it was away. Whereas, as you said, Livingston, that is not a good place to be losing there. I remember famously when they lost at Inverness Caledonian Thistle when the great John Barnes was the manager, and the headline of the Daily Record the next day was "Super Cali Go Ballistic, Celtic are atrocious."
Yeah, legendary headline. All right, well, good luck, Ange. We're all crossing our fingers for you, mate. Look, across to the continent, another club that was, at least until this past week, in its own world of pain, post Cristiano Ronaldo. They've got a result, but Juventus, Derek, what's your assessment on them?
Yeah, people have been quick to draw these lines between Ronaldo going to Manchester United and a sudden uplift in their form and performances. People forgetting, for example, that Young Boys result. Of course, they were dumped out of the Carabao last night by West Ham as well. And then Juventus's decline. They did beat Spezia 3-2 in their most recent game. Spezia are pretty lowly Serie A side, so you'd even expect an out of sorts kind of Juve side to beat them. And they've had a couple of draws, one with and one with AC Milan recently. An amazing goal from Morata. I don't know if anyone has seen that, but it was a stunner. But Allegri has said he said that he is worried. There's no kind of gloss, not like Arteta saying that he's having the best weeks of his career. As he said the other week, he's saying he's worried, and I think he's got every right to be. But Allegri went away after years and years of success, and Juventus have, they've shuffled a couple of managers to start with. So first of all, they went for the respected club legend approach. Pirlo came in. He was in the academy. He came in as a, I don't know if a quick lesson aside, there's like a finishing school for managers in Italy. It's a bit like Oxford or Cambridge, and he came top of his class there. So he was expected great things from him, didn't work out. They brought Sarri in. Sarri didn't ever feel like a Juventus appointment, and it didn't work out. And you just have to wonder whether they stood still trying to appoint the right manager. And then they brought in Cristiano Ronaldo, and of course, for all the goals that he scored, completely destabilized the team, sucked up lots of wages. So it's a total rebuild for Allegri. So while I think he should be worried, I don't think it's time to hit the panic button. There's a very talented squad, but I think Juventus fans, a little bit like Celtic fans, Rob, will just have to be a little bit patient and just look for that rebuild. Interestingly, it is going to be the Rome and Lazio derby coming up next in Serie A. Roma had a great start under Jose Mourinho, albeit they lost their last game 3-2 to Verona. Tammy Abraham leading the line, scoring goals. Spinazzola looking great. Lorenzo Pellegrini looking an amazing player. He's got to be one of the players to watch out to Serie A this season. And of course, Inter, shorn of Lukaku and their manager Conte, top. So Serie A shaping up nicely.
And one little Serie A story that didn't escape our attention during the week was Christian Volpato, who was been invited by Jose Mourinho to train with Roma's first team side, as he is also been called up to the Azzurri's junior side too. And this is all after being overlooked by Australian football. This has happened before. I just can't remember the name of the player off the top of my head. I'm not sure, Willem, whether you'll get it for our regular listeners. They'll be screaming at their phone or radio or whatever device they're listening to us on. But if we lose a player that should be playing for the Socceroos and he ends up in an Azzurri shirt, mate, there will be fading him hell to pay. All right, gentlemen. Well, let's wrap it up there. Another good show. We really did enjoy that conversation with Henry about the legend of Jimmy Greaves, Amy Chapman, wonderful former Matilda. Hopefully, Tony Gustafsson can get that ship turned around real soon. Derek, you have a lovely weekend, my friend.
Yes, thank you very much, and go Doggies.
Aha, interesting. He follows the AFL. I think he might have just plucked that one out of somewhere. I'm not sure where. Willem, you enjoy the weekend as well.
Thank you very much, Rob and Derek.
We will do this all again next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.